Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. Today we sit down with Hannah Raskin, the editor and publisher of the food section in incredible indie food publication newsletter that covers the American South. We talk about her journey in the world of editorial writing, her time as a restaurant reviewer, and how the South is tied together by food. And then it's a deep dip into the archives back to March 2017 when Kid Wave stopped by the studio in Brooklyn to talk about growing up in Sweden, finding musical success in London, and what it's like living in LA. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snaggy Tunes here on HRN.
One, two.
Like your head is upside down. You like my goldfish in a bowl, but still your life goes on and on. I'm always running. Yeah, always running. Always running round. I was never reckless like them kids, because my mind was never still. It's like an ocean running wild, yet always drifting from side to side. I'm always running.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I think this is the first time we have someone calling in from a fast food restaurant, and I couldn't be happier to be talking it like brings nothing but joy to my face. I can't believe it's taken this long.
The unfortunate thing is I think I could have made you even happier, because had there not been a crash on 95, which thank God I was not involved in, but if there had not been, I'd be a little bit further down the road, and I would have called you from south of the border.
Oh, man. The infamous. Have you started seeing the billboards yet? Have they started popping up?
Oh, I think y'all have billboards in New York, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know about the infamous South of the Border I-95 billboards, just do yourself a favor and check them out. Well, I'm happy you joined us. I was reading about your background, and I feel like you got into food writing or came to it in the way that so many of my friends who came into food journalism, I don't want to say accident, but by just like happenstance. And you were supposed to be studying one thing and you're writing an article. I'd love for you to talk about that first article that you started writing about, because it's an issue near and dear to my heart of Chinese food and Jewish community, and how you landed on that and what brought you into that world of writing about food instead of studying what you should have been studying.
Right. Well, it was what I was supposed to be doing. I think what you're alluding to is after a very short-term career in daily newspapers here in the South, I went back to grad school to get a degree in museum studies because as a young and egotistical person, remember, this is before the internet, and I thought it's really unfortunate that my work doesn't last more than a day. So I thought I'll go work in a museum and hang it on the wall. You'll have to look at it for a year.
Right.
So it turns out that's not what museum work is at all. I was wrong about that. But the fortunate thing is that I was in a double degree program. He meant master's in American history in addition to a master's in museum studies. This is the Cooperstown graduate program, which is part of the State University of New York. And so for my master's thesis, I wanted to write about the relationship between Jews and Chinese food, because at that time, and it's crazy, I mean, this is only 25 years ago, it's crazy to think about it now, it was undocumented. Like, it was not that there were, like, you know, crazy community-wide events and, like, you know, memes on social media. There was no social media and there was no documentation. And all I knew was that my family went to Sichuan West every Sunday. And it appeared that other Jewish families did the same, right? And it was just, I had some hunches about why it was that way, but really felt compelled to, like, get it written down. Because, you know, you never know what's going to happen to the Jews next. So I thought it would be a good thing to document.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where, and you bring up the internet and the connectivity between people, but it's like, well, my family did this, or our family did this, and here are these things that are in our little community or pockets, we did it. And then you get out there and it's like, oh, you did this on a Sunday, or you did this on this certain day. And it's, you start to see that connective tissue that connects, like, different communities. Now it's like, I mean, it could be, you know, Chinese food. It can be a lot of other things. It could be like Sunday sauce and what have you. But there's all this connective tissue. What did your family order? You said Sichuan. Do you have a favorite dish?
It wasn't actually Sichuanese. It was just called Sichuan West, and Ann Arbor, Michigan is where I grew up. So I typically get beef and broccoli. You know, in Michigan, almond chicken is a big thing. So almond chicken. I mean, like every good Jewish Chinese meal, it was totally not kosher. Like, we had pork, mushu pork a lot.
Sure. So you started writing this thesis and you're doing museum studies. Did you ever think that this would be the career? Or when did you start thinking about writing about food and covering food as something more than just like, oh, I documented this one thing while I was in grad school?
Sure. Immediately after grad school, I got a job leading mountain bike trips. So I guess it wasn't the first thing on my mind.
Sure.
But because for that reason, I ended up living in Asheville, North Carolina. And so started picking up work at the Alt Weekly there, back when Alt Weeklies were the best thing going. And decided they should cover food. I mean, this is when Asheville was just starting to have, you know, something of a food scene. There weren't really restaurants prior to that. I mean, there were restaurants, but not the kind you would write about in any significant way. And at that point, like I said, I had the academic background. I've been working in newspapers for a while. And because I was working in newspapers, I was waitressing all the way along. So I felt like I was, you know, three times qualified. So that's how I got started.
So when they start covering restaurants and local scene, and you know, was it real criticism and critiques of a restaurant, or is it more FYI? And if it was criticism, how much responsibility did you feel about like giving it like a fair shake, given that you were also getting started in writing about food and that business and livelihood was on the line in some cases?
Yeah. So at that point, it was not, I mean, the community was not big enough to really, you couldn't do negative reviews. And then neither, the paper wasn't big enough for that either. But the way I got around it, which was, I think, morally defensible, and I still feel like it was a journalistically a good choice, was I would go to a restaurant and eat there and would only write about those which I felt were deserving of review. But because the budget was small, it wasn't a true review. The way I would write about restaurants was instead I would sit down with the chef. And again, this is before chefs were like chefs. They were just regular people. Sit down with the chef and you kind of, we'd go through dishes, he'd explain them, but with no like PR intermediary. But again, people knew if I wrote a column about a restaurant, it was my way of saying, this is worth checking out.
Yeah, it's that if you're not reviewed, that says everything that needs to be said. So as you're in the food world.
I should say, I wasn't so nice. I mean, ultimately, going back to our previous conversation, the publisher there did eventually tell me he felt like my writing was a little too New York, which I think we know what that means. And he discontinued the column.
But lucky enough during that time, you know, food started to become more popular. Food media started to actually coalesce into something that people could even call it an actual genre.
Sure.
When did you start to feel that shift as you were working in it? When did you start to think that you could have a livelihood, a career in this type of writing and reporting?
I think when Voice Media Group called me up and offered me a full-time job.
Okay. Yeah. That usually works. And how did they hear about you? And what was your response when they called you?
How did they hear about me? I'm trying to remember who was the person in common. I mean, I had gotten to know some of the other writers in the South at the time. Southern Foodways Alliance was coalescing. So like I got to know some of the writers. I don't know. I think my name was kind of out there in one way or another. It was interesting. I remember, so I started at their paper in Dallas. And I remember my husband and I were in line for the movies, like, should we do it? You know, like our life is so good in Asheville. Do you really want to move to Dallas for my career? And we were describing what was so great about our lives in Asheville, which was basically like, we'd be done with work at 4 o'clock. We could play golf, you know, and the woman in line in front of us in the movies was like, it sounds like you're already retired, you know, and we're like 30 at the time. We're like, probably do something for my career.
God, the idea of moving for a print-based media job these days is such a wild concept. I feel like no one moves cities to be like to write about anything, at least definitely not in the food world these days.
I mean, now that I think about it, even the fact we were standing in line at the movies. That story is totally outdated.
Buried the lead. And we had just paid under $1 for gas and all of that.
Parked our mule and there we were. Yeah.
So, as food became food and chefs became chefs and your own writing style developed, were you splitting your time between reporting, investigative food journalism, and restaurant critiques? Were you splitting that all? And how were you defining those two different disciplines?
Yeah, I did all of it. I mean, this was sort of like the end of the golden age of alt weekly. So they were still pretty scrappy and feisty. And so, it felt like reporting was a significant component of what I did, but I also had to file a weekly restaurant review.
And how did you, because I feel like now, or like it shifted to a point where like the restaurant critic was only, they only wrote critiques. Every once in a while, they'd come out with like a thought piece. And that the food editor side was only about reporting stories, things like that. How did you decide what to report on and how did you decide on what to review when it came to restaurants?
The whole idea is whether you're reporting or reviewing, I do think they go hand in hand because I think a good review is really well reported. You're trying to counterbalance the prevailing narrative. So, anytime, and it wasn't hard to find in Dallas, if somebody's thrown a bunch of money behind a restaurant and they have a message that's out and about, that's my job, is to check it out like any good reporter.
Sure, sure. So you're in Dallas. When did the South, I guess the deep South, South Eastern Seaboard type of area start tricking back into your mind? When did you say that, like, I want to go back to a different part of the country and start working there?
Oh, right away. I had never wanted to. Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really glad for that opportunity because I didn't know Texas, and Texas is the other country in our country. So I'm glad I had the opportunity to explore it. I mean, you know, I hired Daniel Vaughn to write about barbecue, and now he's Texas Monthly write about barbecue. You know, I hired Jose to write about tacos, and now he's a Texas Monthly writer. Like, cool. It was cool. Right. Taking stock of Texan foodways. So that was all a really good experience. But yeah, I wanted to come back south. My first job at college was in Mississippi. So I was happy to come back.
And at that time, and if you can give us a year, like, how much of the story of the South as it pertains to food have been told in the way that we think about it now?
Isn't that interesting? So it's really funny. When I was offered the opportunity in Charleston, which was in 2013, my one concern is, like, there are no stories left to tell. And I wasn't right about that. I wasn't right about that at all. No, I don't think – I mean, yes, but by the time I came back to the South, the whole like, you know, pork and bourbon thing was already pretty well established in terms of, like, the contemporary profile of the South. But for real stories, there was plenty left to do.
Awesome. Well, listen, let's take a quick musical break. I want to talk about your time in Charleston and eventually the food section, your own independent publication. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are chatting with editor and publisher of the food section, Hannah Raskin. So Texas is in the rear view. Charleston is being illuminated by the headlights.
I spent a year in Seattle in between.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was the same. So you know, that was the same company, you know, at that time, whatever it was.
I mean, you did say all weekly, so I should have just assumed that there was another hip, cool city right in the middle.
Yeah, Seattle really quickly. Then in 2013, came to Charleston.
Came to Charleston, and you're at the Post and Courier. What was the mandate of when they hired you there of what they wanted you to say about food? Because again, you're talking about a large investment, or at least a large investment for a local newspaper that's solely focused on culinary. But the year of 2013 makes a lot of sense because food media was really exploding at that time.
Right. So they had a new editor at the paper, Mitch Pugh, who's now the editor of the Chicago Tribune. I was his first hire. He came in and was like, even he knew that Charleston was a food town and could not believe we had no food coverage. We had no food coverage. Whatever. My marching orders were run with it. That was it. I think they really wanted, I think the idea was to bring some of that old alt weekly spirit into the newsroom.
How embedded were you into the Charleston food scene where, you know, it's a bit of a reciprocal relationship with being the food critic and the food editor and getting people to trust you, but you're also having to like be very honest in talking about restaurants. Like, how did you work your way in? Did you know chefs there from being in the South? What was that acclimation like?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I don't think I knew anybody there. I mean, you know, I had eaten at McCready's and things like that, sure, but I never, I didn't know anyone in town. And I don't know. It's funny what you said. I mean, you set it up as sort of like it's dialectic, but it wasn't that. The people, if you tell the truth, that's it. That's where the power lies. It's when you say like people also have to trust you, and they trust you most if you tell the truth, or else they're afraid that you will. It's pretty easy. Yeah,
I guess it's painted a little bit more of my 2024 glasses of what I think the relationship with like food journalists and restaurants are. It's like, it's so much more with like the rise of blogs and, you know, like, like separation of like church and state. Like, going back to that time, there really was like we're from the press.
Right. Interesting you should say that. Okay. Because you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, food journalists have always been super cozy with industry. I mean, that goes back long before blogs, right? I mean, you know the story, like they used to have the Food Journalists Association at the time would have its meetings. This is like the 60s. Its meetings at the same time always as the National Chicken Council, because I guess those guys were really good looking farmer. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Always been super, super close. So but like I said, I had the backing of a newsroom that had a newspaper mentality, but this was all news to the restaurant scene or the restaurant industry. So F&B, so this is, here's my example of what I think what you're saying is exactly accurate, which is that when I came to town, the best known maitre d' in town rang up the editor, was like, so we'd love to throw her a party, a welcome party. And I was just aghast. Oh my God. Yeah. You're not even going to meet me. And so, yeah, I mean, it was, people were, they didn't know what to do with me. You know, like I've had an always long standing rule. Like I don't do one-on-one meetings with publicists. You want to call me? Great. We're not going to meet. I mean, this was back in the day of desk size. Never, ever. Like it was, so yeah, it was, not only was it different for the industry, it was very different for Charleston.
Yes. So, and you did some really good award-winning reporting. When did you feel that you found your footing? Like how long until you were at the newspaper that you felt that like you had really gotten a pulse of the city, was telling the food story of Charleston, and that the restaurant community and the readers at large like understood the narrative that you had been able to define that had been out there that your editor saw and couldn't, when he couldn't believe there wasn't a food editor in place?
Maybe like a month.
For like a whole 4 weeks then. Okay. Okay. What was the story, if you remember, or the review that was like, I've been able to define the thesis of the city when it comes to food?
So the first review I ever wrote, and I was just speaking about this at a summit this morning. I've told the story before, but I do think it's really emblematic of the whole my whole experience, about a restaurant called Justine's Kitchen, which is a really, really dubious place. Both the food was kind of okay, but it's one of these, you know, white owned tribute to a black caretaker. So, I mean, a really outmoded narrative, even then. Back, you know, 10 years ago. And so I wrote both about that and about the fact that, like, the food wasn't that great. And a reader called my editor and said, you know, everything she said was true, but she never should have said it. And while that reader felt that way, there were a lot of readers who didn't. There was a whole discussion that was happening in the upper echelons of Charleston society that people had not been privy to, and they were so happy to hear it. It didn't take but a minute for people to be like, oh, okay, all right, we're going to learn something here.
You know, I mean, that phrase, food is political, has been tossed around so much. And you think, especially in an area that has a complicated history, to say the least, food represents so much more than what's on the plate. And so when you start saying who has the right to cook this food, or this take on the food isn't, or the narrative that they're saying the food represents stirs up emotions just below the surface. And it's very easy to turn a restaurant review into a community-wide discussion.
Yeah. On purpose. Yeah.
On purpose. On purpose.
Yeah.
So you're at the newspaper, you've been at print publications for a while, you're racking up awards, you're racking up accolades. When did you start to see this shift in what traditional media, and I'll call traditional media, print, you know, things like that, start to change in your mind where you're going like, I may need to start thinking about a different way of reporting or different approach to this if I want to keep telling the stories that I want to tell?
Yeah, I still haven't reached that point, I would say. I mean, that is, I am really an old school journalist, and I made no changes. The only reason I left the paper was because I had brought on a part-timer, much younger, much, much hipper to all the social media things. And he was like, man, he's like, you really should apply for the Substack thing. I was like, I never heard of Substack at the time, but they were paying about twice what I made at the paper. So I was like, I'll fill that out. And Substack called me up to say they're offering me money. So I took it.
Now we're going to get to this, but you got in at golden age may not be the right word for Substack, but you got in at the age when a lot of us in media or things like that said like, goodbye old world, hello new world. Here's the way like a digital company is going to fund local journalism and let us tell the stories that we're going to want to tell and report it from, I don't want to say anywhere, but you know, our deadlines, our rules and things like that. So in the early days of Substack, in the early days of kicking off the food section, which is your newsletter, how did you feel? What did you think that the new world was going to look like?
You know, what I always said from the start, I'm sorry, it's such a bad answer, but I was like, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm just going to keep the money myself. That's really what I did. I mean, look, part of why it's called the food section is because I had worked on the food section for, and I didn't even want to change the terminology. Like, oh, I'm going to put this in the food section. And I changed nothing. Nothing. I mean, remember, we were already, people weren't, it was post-pandemic, so already I'm working alone. Literally, I changed nothing. I just started collecting the money myself.
So now that you're your own editor, you're your own sort of, you know, you're not saying like you're not pitching stories to above you. You're like the, I don't want to say the buck stops with you.
Right.
But like, how did you, because I can tell and I know from talking with you that like you have a very set rule of parameters of the stories you want to tell and the reporting you want to do and how deep you want to dig. Like, you're your own backstop. So how did you keep that integrity? How did you decide the stories you want to tell and keep it focused when no one was really telling you what you could and couldn't do?
Yeah, that was had been my deal for 10 years at the paper. So that was another reason why I wanted to, I was never told to write anything, and I was never not told to write it. It just that when I was at the paper, I just did what I wanted to do. There was no, I didn't pitch anyone. No one knew what was coming until they saw it in the paper. Like, I had all the rehearsal I needed to do a one-person newsletter. It's basically what I've been doing. But one of the great things about the Substack package, the very best thing, is they paid for an editor. I'd never had one. And I worked with Steve Fennessy, who was the editor of Atlanta Magazine previously. He's wonderful. And that's been such a treat to get to grow as a writer of this program.
So you have the food section. It's focused on the American South, and you're out on your own. What was the response from the community at large in this role? What was the feedback? Because, and again, I know you had journalistic independence at the Courier, but it's still wrapped up in the package of the Courier. This is very much like, this is me. It's not called the Hannah newsletter, but for all intents and purposes, we're one and the same. What was the response? How did people feel about that? What was the feedback that you got?
I mean, I would say there was some confusion. I learned pretty quickly to never say the word Substack. I mean, people still around where I am do not know what Substack is. That's not, you can't say that. So the idea that I was leaving to start a blog, which I told everyone, I'm starting a blog, that I think people were somewhat confused, but the conclusion was like, it sounds ballsy, sounds creative, sounds like something Raskin would do. So.
And you expanded out of the city, right? You're not just focused on Charleston anymore. You're focused on the South. How did you keep that narrative clear when you're covering such a larger area? And how did you give a fair shake to the larger area instead of just like winding up focusing on the same major cities? Like, how did you pick the big stories, the smaller stories? Where did you start ranking the coverage, especially now that you're a much smaller, well, not much smaller, but it's a different setup.
Yeah, it's different. It's totally different. That was really something to figure out. And I think if anything, that's what was most disappointing to the local audience is I wasn't going to write about them every day. Definitely there was less carryover than I may have anticipated in terms of subscriptions because people are like, I only want to read about the city I live in, which I am so sympathetic to, which is why I'm now growing out this organization. So I will have bureaus across the South so people can do exactly what they want to do. But then, I mean, the nice thing is the South is a very cohesive region. So, you know, if you tell a story that matters in Georgia, it probably resonates in Arkansas. Familiar with the larger themes, all of it is applicable throughout all 9 states in the Southeast.
I mean, I do love that you do talk about the dishes to try that are very regional. Like, obviously, like Gullah Geechee is, if you've done your research, you know that, but you don't know that maybe as a whole when you get, unless you dig into the South a little bit more, or like where to go off the beaten path. You know, how much of this is informational, educational, or just like maybe more of the fun, like, I just want to go and try some food when I hit Mississippi or another city in the deep South.
Yeah. I mean, the idea, it's supposed to be fun. I mean, if I'm not having fun, then my readers aren't going to either. So it's, of course it's fun. But I do not just like arbitrarily ramble. There's none of that. Right? Like, I have to know that there is a story somewhere before I cross state lines. I'll say that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, gas is very expensive these days. So yeah. Right? Yeah. So this is going along and we don't have to get too deep in the weeds because you wrote pretty lengthy about leaving Substack, which I thought was a really great piece. And I recommend if anyone can easily find it if they read it. But just quickly in your mind, like, you go from newspapers to the backing of Substack in its own way. And then you're like, I need to go independent. Why? And what have you seen since you've made that shift to really being like, I'm out there on my own?
Yeah. So, as I wrote about, it became exceedingly clear after the implosion of Twitter that, like, if you are dependent on another platform, right? No, it was really like...
No. Yeah.
Right? And I was like, this is not my own stuff. This is completely conflicts with my whole... I can't say I'm independent when what I'm doing is, you know, building up an audience for Substack. Not for me, not what I do, ultimately. So I wanted out of that universe. I mean, it didn't feel like it was the inclusive, accessible place I wanted to be. I wanted my own thing. So I left.
No,
there are smaller things too, which I wrote about. You know, there are smaller things, which is a huge part of journalism is reader engagement and forging reader trust. And in order to do that, you have to have a very different relationship with them. Namely, you have to know where they live. And so that's been a huge shift. Like prior to this, I didn't know where my readers were. They could have been anywhere. Substack doesn't tell you. And now I handwrite a postcard to every single person who subscribes.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting to see the numbers you talked about of subscribers, free versus paid subscribers, and how really the business model is like you sell ads in there because you have a big subscriber list. Like it's not as altruistic as it seems. And also, you know, not to bring it full circle to your first thesis about where the Jewish community likes to eat Chinese food, any company that's like, you know what, we're not going to censor Nazis. I'm like, let's take a...
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like,
exactly.
I can understand if you're a journalist or you're like, I just don't want that in the platform. Especially right. when you've gone on the... They've gone on the record about that as well.
They've gone on the record, right? And it's like, why should I take a hit for something I didn't even do? You know what I mean? That's the problem. It's like, completely support people who want to cut all ties with Substack. I mean, readers, you know, and it's like, but what, why should I lose that subscription revenue? That doesn't make sense. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you're on your own now. Mm-hmm. You're growing. Mm-hmm. You have a James Beard Award that you've won for the food section.
Yes.
But the media landscape, even from 10 years ago, especially food media, is so wildly different. Mm-hmm. What do you think? How would you even define it now? What would you think it looks like now? And if someone who's writing their own thesis in college about food and culture and saying like, can I even have a career like Hannah? Is that even possible anymore?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like I told you, I just this morning came from the North Carolina News Summit, which is all independent news publishers. They had 180 people. It was sold out with 50 people on the wait list. Isn't that, it's amazing. I don't know. Look, I don't know anything about tech. I have no idea in what form we will be delivering stories. Doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter if it's TikTok, if it's whatever. But I think there will always be a need to tell stories and there will always be people who are wanting to listen. I mean, and most particularly in the field of food, I mean, nobody but your local reporter is going to tell you which chicken dish to get at the Chinese restaurant. So...
Yeah, I love it. I mean, it really goes back to, because I've seen the commodification of food. I've seen food as companies who just use it for their own to push things forward when there's maybe something else under the surface. When at the end of the day, like, I just want to know when I drop into town who I can trust to get a good meal if I'm only in town for one dinner.
Yep. Yeah.
Nice. Well, Hannah, congratulations. I appreciate you pulling off on 95. You know, I grew up in Philadelphia and 995 is near and dear to my heart. If people want to follow along, subscribe, become a member, read what you're reading, dig into the archives, where can they go?
Thefoodsection.com.
Ooh, clean and simple. Big shout out to Ella, Cassandra, and Vanessa for helping to set this up. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
I'm at
Welcome back. Kid Wave live in studio.
Hello.
Thanks for coming by on your way down to Austin.
Oh, thank you.
First time down to South By?
Yes.
Are you excited?
I'm very excited, yeah.
We're going to get to that in a moment, but we're going to start from the beginning. 2011.
Yeah.
You leave Sweden, go to the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Why did you leave Sweden? What was the music scene there? And what did you see or hope to find in the UK?
Yeah, so I moved mainly because, like, I guess I was, you know, I was 19 and I wanted to get out from quite a small town. So I figured London would be the place to go. And so I, yeah, took my suitcase and went. Yeah, I thought that the scene in London was a little bit more vibrant. Where I was from in Sweden, there was literally no music scene. So that was actually the reason why I went in the first place, just to have a scene.
Where were you getting your influences from?
At the time,
when you were still home?
Mainly from my friends' bands, actually. A lot of people think, when they hear the first record, they think that it's from a lot of 90s bands and whatnot. But the reason why it sounds like that is because I was very influenced by my friends' bands, mm-hmm. who are all quite influenced by those bands. But at the time, I had no idea what those bands were. Back then, I was mainly just going to see my friends play. I listened to their records. Weirdly enough, it was just within a quite small circuit of friends.
What did you find when you got to London? Did you find the inspiration looking for besides your friends' bands, or was it not exactly what you had hoped for?
It was what I had hoped for. It was a lot more difficult than I'd thought. So,
in what way?
It was just a challenge to move to London when you're that young and had no money whatsoever. So I found that it was, you know, causing a lot of anxiety and stress. So I guess the lyrical content is a lot about, like, the whole anxiety, whereas the music was kind of already there when I moved. I knew what kind of music I wanted to make. So it was not a case of me going to London and, you know, exploring the music scene and taking it all in and transforming my music into something similar. I think the songs and the music were, like, that I already had a vision when I went. But yeah, the lyrical content definitely inspired it.
were the lyrics there before you moved, or were they adapted when you got there? It's interesting.
Yeah, no, they were all like, when I write, I normally just come up with a musical idea, like an instrumental, and then I come up with a vocal melody, and then the lyrics go on top of that. But I think the lyrics were all kind of like, in the time being, came from there.
And what led you to your first EP, or when did you feel that you were ready to release Gloom?
So Gloom came out once I had, I wrote a couple of songs and I put out a single called All I Want on a Bandcamp page online, and that generated a lot of interest that I wasn't expecting at all. So I was like, oh, I keep writing, keep putting things
that
out. That works, yeah. So I did that, and I wrote a couple of songs, and Gloom was one of them. And there was a label in London called Heavenly Recordings that I had just heard of them, and they had these amazing band on their roster, and they were basically the first label that I sent my songs to. And yeah, I was very lucky.
Just that easy.
Yeah, it sounds like a dream.
You just send it to the first one, they say, sure.
It sounds like a dream, and it was a very old school way of, things to happen. But yeah, it happened, and they picked up on it. And I didn't have a manager or anything at the time. Looking back, a manager would always have gone, let's explore our options. If one label is interested, there might be other labels. But Heavenly turned out to be a great label, and they were very supportive, and ended up putting out my first EP and my first record.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us first?
We're going to play a song of that first record called Honey.
Live on Snacky Tunes. Thank you.
with friend haze, floating in water and fading away, touching the sky for once in my life. Heaven can wait, but not tonight. Leaving the window of things that I lack, wherever I go with you now. Some say dreaming is a waste of time. I've got nothing else in my life. And the lights you took with you, they left me tonight. Surfing down colors and rivers of blood, and the sun making shapes in my head. Some say dreaming is a waste of time. I can't get you out of my mind. Driving down on the 45, and in on the second time.
So you mentioned your LP came out 2015, mm-hmm. Wanderlust. How had living in London influenced that, as opposed to the songs that kind of came pre-written from Sweden?
I think the songs developed with my songwriting. So considering the first couple of songs I wrote when I was 19, I'd just moved to London. I had more time to write the album. Well, everything happened kind of quickly, but I moved to London, put out two songs online, I got the record deal, and a lot of the songs that I had put out as demos online, they wanted on the record as well. So it was a case of going in and re-recording it, and yeah, I guess the newest, like the songs that were added last to the record were, I think, better than...
Is it in the sequencing, like as you get later in the record?
I think so. I mean, I think that my writing gets better and better. And I think any songwriter would say the same thing, because it's all like, you know, you add life experiences to it and your writing gets better. It's like any craft, you do it, and the more you do it, the better you get at it. As you know, as you can say whatever you want, but I think that's the case.
And as you grew and you put your band together, you found a band member from Sweden, from mm-hmm. Australia, from yeah. Britain. Did you like try to make it as multinational as possible? Or is that just how it happened?
No, that was just how it happened. I went to I studied sound engineering for 6 months in London. And at that school, I met Sarah, the drummer, who was from Australia. And the guitarist at the time, he's also Swedish, and he was an old friend of mine back from Sweden, and he's a great guitarist, and I had him play on the demos and a lot of the recordings because he's just amazing. And then I really wanted him to be in the band as well, and he kind of came over and did a few shows with us, and then things got really serious. We got a record deal, and you know, got a booking agent and started going around, And he just had to, you know, make that call whether to move to London or not. And he did. So now I've left London and Matthias is still in London.
So yeah, let's talk about that. You decided to move to LA. So what did you hope to find in LA that you no longer found in London?
I guess it was just the same thing. The same reason why I moved to London, the same reason why I moved to LA. I think the music scene out there is better at the moment. It's a bit cheaper to live still. London got crazy expensive.
Kinda. It's getting there.
It's getting there. That's really the thing, though. I went out last year to LA in the spring, and it was way cheaper back then than it is now. But yeah, the scene is really good out there at the moment, I think. There's a lot of bands. You get, as a musician and artist, you have more space. You can easily get rehearsal space or studio time. Within London, everything's very cramped. It's harder. It's more difficult.
I feel like in LA, everyone has a studio in their house.
Exactly. People seem more chill about it as well, you know?
And you've been finding some local writers to work on songs with. Who have you been working with?
I haven't worked with writers, mainly like musicians, like Jackson, who's here in the studio with me.
Hello,
right
Jackson.
Now.
Hey, guys.
He's a local LA musician, plays in a really good band as well called Snowball 2, worth checking out. just did like a bit of promo there. Basically, I went out to LA. I met a lot of musicians via my friends out there who are all awesome musicians. And and I just found some people to play with and go on tour with.
And did you see your lyrics adapting like when you went out to London to the surrounding of LA? And if so, how?
I think they're more personal, they're more direct now compared to the first record. I think that's more of a natural development of my writing, though. I'm not sure the move to LA necessarily inspired it. I think it's more of having more confidence and being able to put yourself out there a little bit more, which also comes with age, I guess. I mean, I'm not 90. I mean, I'm 24, so it's not like I'm getting old or anything, but it's been 5 years. So, of course, that makes a huge difference in terms of what's happened to you in your life and stuff. But, yeah, not sure LA... Apart from, of course, if you move to a place like LA, you're going to come across some, you know, pretty messed up things. So there's been a lot to write about just because I put myself in those situations where I moved from one big city to another.
Any example you care to share?
I don't know. I feel like it's just in general when, like, London and Europe is quite different to LA. So I found a big clash in kind of, I wouldn't say morals is the wrong thing, but I find that the way people live and are out there is very different. And it's not necessarily right or wrong. It's just different. And I don't know, I've just been in, like, there's been so many, like, weird parties. I went to, like, a wake, like, somebody's wake, and that was, like, a big party, like, a house party. Stuff like that is just, like, fucked up. So, I don't know, it's just been a lot to take in, I think, in terms of it's being very different from where I'm from.
Can we hear another song? What are you going to play for us?
We're going to play another song of the first record called Wanderlust.
Like your head is upside down. You like my goldfish in a bowl, but still your life goes on and on. I'm always running. Yeah, always running. Always running round. I was never reckless like them kids, because my mind was never still. It's like an ocean running wild, yeah, always drifting from side to side.
Currently on tour with the Shins.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
That came about as my manager or somebody in that team actually sent James Mercer my new demos. And yeah, he kind of I know, it sounds crazy. And yeah, he really liked it apparently and offered me to come on tour with him.
And here you are. So where, and you have a couple shows at a show at Baby's All Right too this week.
Yeah, I'm playing my first ever headline show at Baby's All Right tomorrow.
Which is the best venue.
Super excited. I've
Billy
never been.
And the team have been on the show before. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's become after all the venues in Brooklyn shut down, it's become the de facto.
Yeah.
And not by default. It was already great and now it's just the only one left.
I think coming from like outside of New York, Baby's All Right is the venue everyone's heard about, like in terms of smaller venues and smaller bands and stuff. So.
And it's just great. And when you get on stage with the lights behind, it's awesome.
Awesome.
And then where are the shows with the Shins?
The show on Tuesday is going to be at the Bowery. And the one on Wednesday is at Music Hall of Williamsburg.
And then you are on your way to South by Southwest.
And then literally coming off stage at Music Hall and going straight to the airport, pretty much. No, we're flying out really early in the morning.
So as someone's first South By in 2017, what are your thoughts on it and what are you hoping to get out of it?
The thing is, everyone keeps telling me it's amazing. And then everyone keeps telling me it's not as good as it used to be. And then everyone's going to tell you that it's not as good as it used to be, but it's still very good. Yeah. So I'm just super excited. And I know for a fact that it's going to be very hectic because we're doing multiple showcases on like each day. So I'm going to go out there and probably just be running around like crazy. But then we have a day off as well on a Saturday where we're just going to... No, on the Sunday, I think.
Well, a fun fact is that Lin Yi and I first met at South By when I was still in college.
Yeah.
When she was working at Fader and she turned me away from the party. And she didn't do like a full body turn. She did the you're not on the list and then kind of the like... quarter inch turn where you're not on the line side, and then 6 months later I was her intern at Fader because I was like, well, that's not gonna fly with me. So
that's what you gotta do, right?
That's what it's gotta do. We want to make sure we have time for one more song. Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining.
No, thanks for having me.
Yeah, outside the tour, anything coming up? Other LP?
Yeah,
future writing plans?
There's an EP coming out.
Okay.
To bridge over to the second album. So this might be the first announcement of it, but yeah, there's an EP coming out, and the song that we're going to play now is the first single of the EP. It's called Everything Changes, and then there's more singles coming, and then yeah, the EP drops I think sometime in the summer or early summer.
Same label?
No.
New label. Who's the new label?
Actually Secret.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not the name of the label, just actually a secret. So where can people find you, catch you on tour, get all the information?
They can find me on all social channels as Kidway Music. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you name it, I'm everywhere. And they can, we're touring now with the Shins and doing South By, and then I'm doing two shows in LA. I've got a headline show in LA coming up as well at the Echo on the 15th of April. And then probably keep touring.
Just keep going.
Yeah, keep going.
And writing music.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Lin Yi, thank you. Make sure to go to bit.ly/allcapsmold, capital M, mag, to contribute to the Kickstarter. Appreciate everyone coming by today, and we will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. Take us out.
Cool.
We talk about food, we talk about music. Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Subscribe.